This hour of the Jason Rand Show is brought to you by Northwest Safe. There is a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? Happening now.
So Democrats are ready to impeach President Donald Trump. They are starting their impeachment inquiry officially, which of course is a little bit weird because we've really been seeing this happen over the course of the last several months. Progressives have called now for the documents about the call where Trump supposedly had a quid pro quo offer with the president of Ukraine, all to investigate ties between sort of corrupt actions and a corrupt business with Joe Biden's son. Now, despite not having these details yet, they've decided to call for this inquiry officially.
The president has admitted to asking the president of Ukraine to take actions which would benefit him politically. The actions of the Trump presidency revealed the dishonorable fact of the president's betrayal of his oath of office, betrayal of our national security, and betrayal of the integrity of our elections.
Right now on the Hill, Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Congressman McCarthy, is speaking live. We go to him as he delivers the Republican response.
It's no different than what Nadler's been trying to do. It's time to put the public before politics. Thank you.
Mr. McCarthy, are you afraid that you're on the wrong side of this issue in some way?
That was the tail end of Leader McCarthy. We're expecting to hear from Steve Scalise also, but he is not going to speak. So again, what he's basically doing there and what he did, because we missed the first 30 seconds or so of his reaction, is say, this has been going on for a very long time. You've got absolutely nothing new. You've been calling for impeachment for the last 3 years almost. Nonstop calls for impeachment. It would appear that no matter what you're able to find in this latest investigation into the potential quid pro quo with the president of Ukraine, no matter what, you're going to move forward with this. And that's why earlier today, the president was calling this out as a witch hunt.
I think it's ridiculous. It's a witch hunt. I'm leading in the polls. They have no idea how they stop me. The only way they can try is through impeachment. This has never happened to a president before. There's never been a thing like this before. It's nonsense. And when you see the call, when you see the readout of the call, which I assume you'll see at some point, you'll understand. That call was perfect. It couldn't have been nicer. And even the Ukrainian government put out a statement that that was a perfect call. There was no pressure put on them whatsoever. But there was pressure put on with respect to Joe Biden. What Joe Biden did for his son, that's something they should be looking at.
So he, of course, is referencing the phone call he had with the president of Ukraine. And again, he said that he hopes it will get out. It's going to be released tomorrow. We're going to get a release of the transcript. We're supposed to get it tomorrow. But of course, that's why some progressives are saying, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, we know how the president acts. Can we really trust this document? You guys are calling for the document. The president then releases it, and they're still going to say, well, there's probably more to it. Doesn't that sound kind of like the whole Mueller situation? Doesn't that sound exactly like that? Now, of course, there are two giant holes in this argument for starting officially the impeachment inquiry, at least based on this Ukrainian story. Number one, we have no clue yet what was said to the president of Ukraine. We have no clue whatsoever what's actually in that transcript. None. Number two, we have no idea what was said in the whistleblower complaint. Supposedly, by the way, by someone who didn't actually get it firsthand, who didn't hear what he ends up reporting or she ends up reporting firsthand. That's kind of important. That seems incredibly important if you're going to decide that you're going to impeach someone over something you haven't even seen yet. There is such a huge, huge potential to backfire for the Democrats here. Because if there's not something really damning and damaging in this transcript or in this whistleblower release, if there's not something incredibly incriminating in it, all they've done is yet again cry wolf, and they did it in a major way. Because today is history was made today. You don't usually get these official proclamations of impeachment inquiries. You don't get that. Today, history was made when Nancy Pelosi decided to run out there and say that and announce that. You better damn well have something tomorrow or on Thursday. when we're supposed to get more information on this whistleblower complaint. Here's what I honestly don't understand. If we're taking them for their word, which is probably my biggest mistake, and I'll address that in a second. But why would you do this right now? Why would you not wait until tomorrow? Why would you literally not wait one day, less than 24 hours from when she made this announcement at 2 o'clock this afternoon? Why not wait less than 24 hours to make this announcement, at least having your hands on the transcript? Why don't you wait? And the answer is really simple. They're not going to wait because they're using this for cover. All of this Ukrainian stuff is being used for cover to start the inquiry officially because they've already said how many times that they want to impeach the president. AOC and her squad have been out there for 2+ years calling for impeachment. You have the Congressman Al Green calling for impeachment over and over and over and over again some more. You've got Elizabeth Warren calling for impeachment. They've been calling for impeachment this entire time, and they're hoping maybe this time, because in their heads they think, well, some of the reporting on the whistleblower report seems damning. They're hoping there's going to be something there. And if there isn't, it doesn't matter, because they were going to go down this pathway anyway. Because in a lot of ways, they started this process weeks ago with Jerry Nadler, months ago with Jerry Nadler, when they took control of the House, when they announced that they were going to do investigation after investigation, we're going to look at absolutely everything. They already started the inquiry. They wanted to impeach, and now they're trying to find evidence to support their impeachment. And this, of course, can backfire so, as President Trump would say, hugely, bigly. Here's what I don't understand. If President Trump did something wrong in this phone call, as has been alleged, and Democrats are making that point that in at least one phone call, he pressed the Ukrainian president really hard to look into Joe Biden. If that's true and they did something illegal, why would the president put out the transcript? Now, I'm assuming the transcript is put out relatively in full. There's always some stuff that you might not be able to include, but that gives openings to people like Chris Hayes, who already on MSNBC already today is complaining that the transcript can't actually be trusted. Why would he put out the transcript if there was some damning evidence in it? He's not being forced into this position to do it tomorrow. And yet that's what he's doing. Now, it's possible that the transcript might look bad, might sound bad. It might be politically damaging. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. But it can look bad and not actually be criminal. And it was a point that was made by Andy McCarthy over on Fox News, the former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. It can look bad and still be kosher, criminally speaking.
I think Gerald Ford said in 1970, an impeachable offense is anything the House of Representatives decides is an impeachable offense at a moment in history. So, you know, if they had the votes, you could make anything into an impeachable offense. But in terms of whether you really have high crimes and misdemeanors, I think we all used to know before Trump was president that presidents can do things that are outside the bounds of what they ought to do and still fall well short of committing impeachable offenses. And that it seems to me that unless they can show that, and this is even beyond, I think, beyond that, but if they could show that Trump said to the Ukrainian president, if you don't open an investigation of Biden, you are not getting the $391 million, then you might have something. But if he had done that, I can't imagine that he'd be releasing the transcript.
Why would he release the transcript? I'm still waiting for an answer beyond, doesn't matter what's in the transcript. They know that most people out there, not you guys who are listening to the show right now, whether it's live or on the podcast, they know that the vast majority of people, they're not going to read into this. They're not going to look at the transcript. They're just going to hear what happened today, and they're going to say, wow, this must be a big deal because Nancy Pelosi decided to make this announcement the way that she did in such a serious tone because they must have something in that transcript. I'm not even going to read it. Most people aren't going to read it. That's why it's so important that we talk about this, and we're going to continue this conversation, including your text messages on the None Better Tax Resolution hotline at 1-800-465-8770. If you want to weigh in on this, text me, 1-800-465-8770. 1-800-465-8770. Send me your text messages on the None Better Tax Resolution hotline, 1-800-465-8770. Let's keep finding out what's trending.
What's trending? Happening now.
Obviously, we're going to continue our conversation about the impeachment inquiry announcement that was made by Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi, at 2 o'clock this afternoon, because it's not just about them taking this kind of gamble and hoping that people don't pay attention, but it's also about making sure that the Democratic Party is truly on her side. Now, we saw these reports of up to a dozen more Democrats, including freshman Democrats, getting on board the impeachment train, and that kind of pushed Nancy Pelosi into this position. But let's be very, very clear. We've got some Democrats who won in red cities, red counties, cities and counties in states that went to Donald Trump. And we've already started to see some of these more moderate Democrats come out and say, well, okay, well, I'm not where you want me to be just yet. I'm not there yet. I'm not going to go ahead and say I support impeachment. Let's actually wait and find out what it is that we find. Because it's really easy for someone like Pramila Jayapal or Denny Heck, who are here in Washington, who seem to be in areas that like their progressive politics, to say, yes, impeach at all costs, because they have branded themselves as anti-Trump. But it's a little bit different when we're talking about someone who's, say, in Iowa or in Montana or Idaho, or any of these states or counties that clearly are still Trump country, to come out and say, oh, yeah, let's go ahead. It's going to hurt them. And there seems to be no doubt, especially in a case like this, because unless something dramatically changes, let's say they go through it in the House, then it goes to the Senate. The Senate, they don't have the votes, right? They don't have the votes to impeach in the Senate, to uphold whatever they find in the House. So at that point, then the American public is going to see, oh, I guess it wasn't that big of a deal anyway. Because the senators, they're the adults in the room. They're not the children like they are in the House. These are the people who put country above all. And they said no. And then it's going to go back and it's going to bite a lot of these Democrats on the backside. And it's going to hurt in the 2020 election. Now, Tulsi Gabbard, who's a congresswoman, Democrat, she's running for president. She's got no shot. She's making a similar point, because if you want to go ahead and impeach President Trump, go for it. Okay. See what happens in 2020. Because you had Clinton actually breaking the law, right? He perjured himself. He actually broke the law. They went through with the impeachment. What happened to the Republicans who were in power at the time? They got demolished in the next election. Donald Trump is going to probably survive any kind of impeachment the same way Bill Clinton did. What happened to Bill Clinton after the impeachment? He got reelected. What do you think is going to happen to Donald Trump after an impeachment? He's going to get reelected. Here's Tulsi Gabbard.
Divisive for our already very divided country.
Even on an impeachment inquiry.
I think Congress needs to exercise oversight over the information that's been leaked. I think that it's important that this transcript is released to Congress so that Congress can do its job. But I think the question of impeachment really would further tear apart an already divided country. I think it's important that Donald Trump is defeated. I believe I can defeat him in 2020. But it's the voters who need to make that choice unequivocally.
So we got a text from the 360. Tom writes, they all take an oath to the Constitution, yet they put their party's interests above our true national interests while Rome burns. And it's absolutely right. This is nothing but politics. As the wise texter on the 425 texts in on the None Better Tax Resolution hotline, they don't care what's in the transcript. In fact, they may even be afraid that there's nothing in the transcript. Right now, the accusation has encouraged some Democrats on the fence to join Team Impeachment. It also gives Pelosi a reason to finally join Team Impeachment in a way that she can step to the leadership of that team. If they wait for the transcript to come out and it bombs, they'll lose those people. I think that's actually rather astute. Maybe that's why they call this individual on my text line the wise texter. I think that's part of it. They don't care what's in this transcript. They hope it's something damaging, but that's just a hope. If it's nothing, they've already made the big spectacle. And it's kind of hard to call officially for an impeachment inquiry if you've already put out a transcript that's not as damning or damaging as they had hoped. And by the way, because this has some significant 2020 implications beyond simply going after Donald Trump, you've got Joe Biden in all of this. You've got Joe Biden and his son in a company that most seem to admit pretty readily was absolutely corrupt. And this is going to hurt Joe Biden, which is why he's still kind of towing the line on impeachment. But Ian Bremner, analyst on CNN, he made the point today, this is not good for the Joe Biden candidacy.
Biden does have a problem here, by the way. I mean, I have to say, $50,000 a month for Hunter Biden, clearly to be selling influence, because otherwise no one would ever pay him that kind of money for a company that frankly was pretty corrupt and has been before and has been since under
investigations. And is that Joe Biden's fault or problem?
No, but it's hard to imagine Joe Biden wasn't aware of it. And I think that I expect that President Obama, if he had known about the reality of this situation, would have probably told Biden, get rid of this. Like, we shouldn't have your son working in this situation. That would have cost him something. And I fear, like, even if maybe Biden wasn't aware, but Biden should have been aware that that would cause a cause an issue for him.
That's an important point, because let's say something just doesn't look good in the transcript, but there's clearly no quid pro quo. If there's no quid pro quo, then the Democrats really have nothing other than the optics of it. And yes, it clearly looks bad if a president is asking another country, a foreign leader of another country, to do some investigation into someone that he may be running against in 2020. It certainly looks bad. However, what's a really good defense to that? All he has to do is come out there and say, we had some clear possibilities of corruption that's tied to the former vice president. You don't want us to investigate? I thought you were all about the party of investigating bad dealings, corruption, nefarious intent. And all of a sudden, when it's someone on your side, you don't want us to actually investigate? It is my duty to do the investigation. I had a brief phone call with the foreign leader who would be able to look into this. I asked him to do it because there was corruption. That seems, to the average person who's kind of on the fence and isn't following this all that closely, that's a really good argument. You mean to tell me that because Donald Trump is running against potentially Joe Biden in 2020, that means any illegal actions undertaken or corrupt actions undertaken by Biden should never be discussed or investigated by this administration because of that potential conflict? That's not going to fly. Let's be clear. The calls for impeachment for pretty much everything coming from everyone from AOC to Pramila Jayapal, that's also being done for political reasons. And this is part of the reason why when Biden is asked questions about his ties with Ukraine or his son's ties and what he did or did not know, he kind of just ignores it.
We know who Donald Trump is. It's time to let the world know who we are. Thank you very much.
Oh, he's not stopping. Oh, he's not stopping. He's not going to say anything. Of course not. He wants this kind of to go away, but at the same time, he wants to be able to take advantage of it. Now, the president has, of course, sent out a number of tweets, including calling this all presidential harassment. He points out, and I think this is a this is a perfect tweet for this situation. And it's going to resonate with people who are down the middle. He says, quote, they never even saw the transcript of the call, a total witch hunt. You tell me that that's not going to connect with someone who doesn't love or hate Donald Trump, goes into it open-minded, uncomfortable with some of the rhetoric, but kind of likes the direction that their personal finances are going right now under this president, likes a lot of the positions that he's taken, likes the fact that he's about law enforcement, likes the fact that he, yeah, you know what? He's a little bit heavy on the rhetoric, but he's tough. But they're not totally comfortable. They look at something like this, you're pushing people into Donald Trump's camp, unless there's something damning in this transcript. Again, we should wait and see what's in the transcript. We should read what we can of the whistleblower complaint. I have no problem with that because, frankly, if the president broke the law, he should 100% be impeached. I just don't know if it's a valid argument coming from the Democrats to scream about impeachment for almost 3 years straight. And then us look at this and say anything other than, oh, really, again? We're doing this again? hey, honey, they called for the impeachment again. I know, it's a pain in the ass. Yeah, just put on Dancing with the Stars. I think Spicy's going to get kicked out tonight. That's basically what's going to happen. 1-800-465-877 to keep those text messages coming on the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline. AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. Seattle's Socialist City Councilwoman Shama Sawan is back with the bad idea that just won't go away, rent control. She unveiled her plan last night at a press conference that kind of was masquerading as a committee hearing. Her proposal limits rent increases to the rate of inflation. Of course, state law here in Washington says you actually can't go ahead with rent control, but that's not stopping her from moving forward anyway. Someone who actually understands the danger of rent control is our next guest, Marilyn Yim. She owns a triplex where she occupies one of the units and rents out the other two. Marilyn, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
So this is not the first time this idea has been pitched by Shama Sawant. What's your main concern?
Okay. We're small landlords. We live in a triplex with our family and rent out the other two units, and that was basically a solution so that we could be able to live in the city with our family and raise our children here. We couldn't otherwise qualify for a single-family home loan on our own. So having two rental units helps us to be able to qualify for a mortgage, but it also helps us to pay the mortgage. But it only helps. I mean, there are other costs of home ownership and of being a landlord that factor in here, and rent control, even at, 2% or 3% of inflation, just does not cover that cost at all. So I'm really concerned that we won't be able to keep up maintenance on our house to the level that we think is appropriate for our family and for our tenants that are living there, and that we may have to consider, you know, getting out of it as a long-term thing, or maybe even consider something else in between. Take our units off the market and use them as short-term rentals, for instance. That's come up as an idea.
So
it'll basically impact our ability to maintain, but also impact the housing supply in the city when we're right now in a housing crisis and an affordability crisis.
What goes into a decision from your perspective in whether or not you're going to raise rates? So let's say you were interested in raising it more than the 2 to 3% of inflation. What would go into that decision?
Well, there's a lot of costs of owning a rental, you know, and a lot of that it's going to be happening anywhere you are in the state, right? You've got regular maintenance, any kind of repairs that have happened. And because we live there, you know, we do really pay attention. We are very responsive and attentive and fix things right away. So things do go wrong. You know, you have a water heater that breaks or whatever. But in addition to that, in the city of Seattle, we also have additional costs. You know, the utilities have gone up quite a bit, you know, sewer, water, garbage. That's another cost. And then the city also has imposed on landlords, they do inspections, and so we live in an older home. And, you know, if it was just our home, nobody would be looking at our house. But they've come in and looked at it to, you know, the current codes. And so we actually ended up spending in 1 year $4,300 on inspection, reinspection, registry,
wow,
and the repairs that they called for. And none of them were life safety issues, you know. So the city's, they're trying to maintain a good standard of housing, but it did add cost. And, you know, it caused us to actually add an increase to our rent, which was very modest. I think it was $50 a month for our basement unit. But it surprised our tenants because, you know, we'd been kind of keeping it pretty slow and steady. And so we had to tell them, look, you know, our taxes went up, this happened. And they knew that we'd been doing that work. So it was all justified, but...
So you're not...
Sorry, that was a long answer. But...
No. But what you're basically saying is you're not the greedy landlord that Shama Sal wants to pretend is like the average person out there. And just... And that's what kind of throws me in this discussion, is just seems like a fundamental either misunderstanding or willful ignorance of the work that landlords are actually doing.
Right. We're providing housing that is good quality, it's affordable, and we are very close to our tenants. We treat our tenants as they're our neighbors, right? They live at the same place that we live, and we actually have a relationship with them. So, no, there's nothing cold-hearted about this at all. In fact, we've been there when, you know, our tenants had a short-term crisis. And so because we don't have a rent control situation, we have some freedom and some flexibility to say, okay, well, we'll bend or we'll flex on here because we know who you are, we like you, we think you're, you know, you're working hard on this, and we're willing to help you out this time. So that's the kind of benefit that small landlords provide, that kind of flexibility, really hands-on. We're part of this community. I love this city. And, you know, and we work together on this. I think that that kind of personal touch is somewhat missing in a lot of these conversations. You know, it's taken as kind of this battle, you know, of extremes of corporate versus, I don't know, workers. And I'm a worker too, you know. I'm not a corporation.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking with Marilyn Yim. She is a landlord here in the Seattle area. She owns a triplex where she occupies one of the units with her family, but rents out the other two. Last night, Shama Sawan unveiled yet another proposal for rent control. This is happening in the midst of her campaign for reelection, which is not going the way that she had hoped. She's running up against someone who's a small business owner who, you know, has a better sense, I think, of the community and the business needs. Have you been able, Marilyn, to either connect directly with Shama Sawan's office or go through an organization to make sure that your perspective is actually being heard?
I haven't directly contacted her about this one. I have tried on other ordinances that have been proposed to meet with various council members. I used to try just the email, and then I tried phone calls, and now I have actually been successful in getting in-person meetings, but I think it's partly because of persistence, and they're starting to know. they're starting to hear from me, and you know, I do put in the effort. I read their ordinances. I try to be very constructive and detailed. You know, I look at myself as I want to be a part of the solution. I'm not trying to create problems, but I think that we can work together to get a better result together. It does not have to be adversarial. And so I'd really like to see that going forward, you know, a better working relationship with landlords in the city as a part of the housing crisis and housing affordability solution.
How would you describe the relationship between the council and the landlord community right now?
Well, I can refer back to a UW study from about a year ago, June of 2018, that found that small landlords like me, 40% are considering selling or getting out of they're either sold or considered selling to get out of the Seattle market. And it was directly related to a lot of the actions that the current council has taken that have negatively affected our ability to continue providing good quality, well-maintained, affordable housing in the city.
What specifically? Because I know we've had conversations on this show on a number of occasions of different policies that have either been discussed or passed and now being, you know, challenged in court. This idea that the first come, first serve, who's qualified, you're supposed to automatically deem qualified for the rental apartment, that just seems kind of ridiculous to me.
Yeah, the ones that were active at the time the study was done were, you mentioned one, the first-in-time ordinance, and also the one that the city calls Fair Chance Housing, which is the one affecting landlords' ability to access criminal records. But there have been others as well. It's kind of a big aggregate effect, you know. You might think of one of these things and think, hey, that sounds like a good idea, and then next year there's another one. Well, that sounds fair. But when you take it all together, you know, landlords have to keep up with all of these things, and it's changed so quickly. It's really made it difficult, I think, for a small-time person like me to continue or to even consider entering the market. You know, the city's trying to get small, like single-family owners to consider putting an ADU in their basement or a detached ADU in their backyard, and then they would then become a landlord. But it's hard to justify the cost, the construction cost, and the startup costs of doing that when you've got something like rent control facing you, and then you really have to ask the question, are you going to be able to recover the initial costs and then make this worthwhile long-term?
Well,
so
what,
it's really eliminating an important housing solution from, you know, the toolbox that we could be using right now to address the issues that we're having of trying to have enough housing types for different types of different income levels, different family structures. You know, we want to have a good wide cross section available to people, and so this is somewhat directly, I think, going to be impacting the development of these future housing units, and then also the ones that are available right now as people look at this, look at rent control and think, can I even continue like this? Am I going to be able to, you know, recover all the costs of the maintenance that we're doing and so forth?
What I find...
And investment, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
It also decreases the amount of investment that's going on.
Totally.
And you know that there have been studies, and not just studies, but just, you know, data and experience. If you look at other cities that have rent control, San Francisco, New York City, Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
These are not affordable cities.
They're not at all. And what I usually hear back from someone like Shama Sal, when she made this point last night at her press conference that was being passed off as a committee, was, hey, you know what? This is just a start. If there's any concerns, we could always tweak it because we don't want to go after people like Marilyn Yim. They don't want to go after the small business owners like you. But that's just not true. They put these master plans out there. It's meant to make this big picture proclamation about how evil corporations are. They do none of the work beforehand. They shouldn't have to say, you know, we're gonna tweak it here and there to make sure we're not doing anything that's going to hurt people. No, just do that from the beginning. If this is the plan you want, then this is the plan we're going to review. Do you take a position, and this will be my last question for you, are you looking to compromise on this, or are you simply saying this is just wrong for the city, regardless of whether or not they're targeting folks like you or some of the bigger companies out there?
Rent control itself has really not been proven to work anywhere, and so I'm skeptical that there's even any amount of tweaking that can make it work. And I'm basing that on the fact that, you know, rent control is not implemented the same way everywhere. You know, it's different in all these other cities where it is now, but you do see similar effects where it decreases the amount of investment in new housing starts. People take current rentals and they convert them into condos or owner-occupied, and they just get out of the rentals completely. And then the rentals that are there, not just the rentals, but even the non-rent-controlled units nearby tend to suffer from deferred maintenance. And that was found in Cambridge, Massachusetts. That was also established in a well-done, documented study.
Exactly. We like to say we don't want to become San Francisco, and yet we continue to go down these paths of becoming San Francisco or New York City or any of the other cities where housing is incredibly unaffordable and is usually a direct result of policies like this. I wish you the best of luck, obviously.
And, you know, I'm sorry if I can interject. You know, Seattle, we really consider ourselves to be creative. We have a lot of creative energy in the city. And I really feel like we can pull together to come up with some effective solutions that really do address the housing crisis and affordability situation that we're in right now. But we do have to work together. And so fighting really doesn't push the ball any further down the field.
Especially folks, understand that Shama Sawant right now is fighting against a state law. There's no indication that the state is willing to change the rent control policies or the ban on rent controls from individual cities. And yet she's putting this out there, and she does it in a way that's really good for her campaign, but not necessarily good for people like Marilyn Yim, who, again, I'm going to assume you don't go home and swim in a pool filled with $100 bills that you stole from people because of your greed. So I appreciate the work that you're doing. I wish you the absolute best of luck in this fight. You've got a lot of people on your side, Marilyn.
Thank you, Jason. I really appreciate you saying
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rancher. That was Marilyn Yim. She is a landlord here in Seattle. Welcome back to The Jason Rancher Show. Have another update and some more info at the top of the hour from today's big political news, where President Trump is now going to officially face impeachment inquiry, even though they're basing it on some stuff that they don't have in front of them. But we'll get into that in a second, because there is still some, of course, local issues that are incredibly pressing, especially if you live in North Bend, where they found E. coli in the water. And it's taking its toll not just on the folks who live there, but also the folks who work there. The Salal Water Association in North Bend is still asking anyone who gets their water from them to boil their water at least until October 1st. The boil water notice means that Snoqualmie Valley School District campuses can't use their water fountains. They're giving out bottled water, but it also means that some businesses there are closing their doors, including Riverbend Cafe. Their owner talked to King 5. His name is Rich Mackey. He spent all of Monday morning calling his suppliers, saying, look, we're temporarily closed. We can't take on any products.
The employers are calling me and say, what do you know? As much as you know right now, we're going to be closed for at least another week. So sorry that it's happening. Unfortunately, I'm not going to need to place an order for a couple weeks.
So, of course, that is causing some problems with him, because when you own and operate a restaurant, the margins are incredibly thin to begin with. This is not a guy who's running hand over fist to the bank with all of the profits that he's making. And on top of that, he's got employees that he can't offer any hours to because they're closed.
How long will the turnaround be? Am I going to be able to remain in business? Across the street, people are having to boil their water. I'm expecting anywhere from $35,000 to $40,000 that I'm going to lose in sales. It's like, what are we going to do? I'm trying to work my way through this. How do we stop this from happening again?
So, you know, these things can happen. It's incredibly rare, but these things can happen. And I kind of want to figure out if it's possible, and I don't, maybe this is too much to ask. Can we find out how this happened in the first place? Because all the reports I'm seeing, the Salo Water Association doesn't know yet what caused the E. coli to be found in the water supply there. And that feels like they should probably figure it out, because if it's due to their own issue, something that they were responsible for or should have been responsible for, shouldn't they be on the hook to pay out businesses that are impacted by the E. coli in the water? Shouldn't they have to? Do they have insurance for this kind of stuff? My assumption is yes, but I don't know.
You would think they would be held responsible,
You know, if it was due through, some people are suggesting that because they had some heavy rains, maybe that had to do. I don't know how that would get E. coli into the water necessarily, but do we not account for potential heavy rains in North Bend? Does it not rain in North Bend, but everywhere else in Western Washington? It
doesn't rain in Washington, period.
I'm just throwing that out there. I get that, you know, these kinds of heavy rainfall like we saw a couple weeks ago is relatively rare, especially in that amount of time, but it does seem like that's something you should prepare for, and if they didn't, then they should be on the hook. Now, how do you prove how much money an individual company would have been able to get? I don't know. I suppose you can look over the course of the last 4 or 5 years and see on average what do they make during that same week and that same time period and come up with an average. But, you know, if this guy is out because of anything due to the operations of Salal Water Association, they should be on the hook. If they did everything the exact right way, then I feel especially bad for this guy because I ain't paying for it.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not. I mean, start a GoFundMe pay. I am not doing it.
I mean, you would never start a restaurant either.
No. God. I'm good for two things. Talking into a microphone and talking about talking into a microphone. It's the Jason Rant Show.